Messiah's Branch Broadcast, a one-hour prophecy program on the American Voice Radio Network, featuring Pastor Dan of Messiah's Branch Ministry. And now, here's Pastor Dan.
Greetings, saints, and welcome to the Messiah's Branch Prophecy Hour. We are broadcasting live from the Flint Hills of Kansas, and we're on the American Voice Radio Network. Today's date is June 12, 2014. Saints, the world is in turmoil. Most just do not realize it, but we are in the time of the end, and that's the time before Messiah's glorious return. So it's time to get out of sin, the world, and look to the holy city. Look to the one who suffered and died for you. Please make this choice tonight. If you need help after this program, call me. I'll pray for you or with you. If you get the machine, please leave your name, your number, your prayer request, or message. The phone number, of course, is 620-878-4682. 620-878-4682. And in emergency, my cell phone number is 316-619-4886. Remember, that's for an emergency, and it is my cell phone, but I am here for you. You can always find updates to the breaking news, our ministry radio program archives, and our mailing address at our blog, which is simply prophecyhour.com. Or if you want to know how to donate to this ministry, because our mission church just works off your kind donations, and that's what it's been for the last. Now we're working on our 15th year. We started that in June. But if you're like one of those 15% of the people that do not listen to or don't use the internet, that don't use the internet, you can call me for anything that you need. Okay? All right. Now we've got a pretty explosive program for you tonight. You want to pay attention to this one and share it with your friends. Anyway, first a prayer, then the guests. Dear Heavenly Father, in Yeshua HaMashiach's name I pray, Father, I pray that radio tonight goes according to your will and that you give our guest the right words in where he can make the people understand. For Father, this is bombshell information. So Father, please, by the blood of Yeshua, I ask you to keep all bad things away from this program tonight and let it come out as you want it to come out. In Yeshua HaMashiach's name, amen and amen. Well, tonight we're going to again explore things that mainstream media just will not touch. Many will say, oh, not another talk about Benghazi. Well, this is more getting closer. I don't know if there's ever going to be a finale about Benghazi, but tonight we're going to get sure close to it. And it's not like our guest is, he's going to tell you something that's pretty shocking, maybe to some of you. But what I will say, we have to remember about everything that this radio guest has came on the air over the years and talked about. While maybe we couldn't confirm it within a month or two or even a year, the mainstream media picked up on it later and nothing. Not anything that he said has so far ever fell to the ground. So let me read you the headline from one of the articles that he's going to be talking about. It says, explosive. Filmmaker behind the Benghazi attack found to be a confirmed Muslim agent who worked with the U.S. government. Well, I have a further headline that I'm going to tell you that he just sent me. It says Benghazi filmmaker is confirmed to be an agent of Eric Holder's Justice Department. So let's bring on Ben Barrick with us and ask him about it. Ben is an investigative talk radio host, and he also works with Wally and Shubat. You can find his work at benbarrick.com and shubat.com. He's the author of two books so far, Unsung Davids and Islamophobia, which he co-wrote with Wally and Shubat. So welcome, Ben. Are you there with me?
Pastor Dan, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I've been on the edge of my seat ever since you sent me the articles, and then you sent me that little email, and I sent you one back, said, well, I'll read them, and you said, do it now, And I read it, and I'm
yeah.
I fell out of my chair when I read it. I went, huh? I got to reread that. And I read it like three times, you know, and I went,
yeah.
Oh, man. And then I posted it. It's up on prophecyhour.com. And I put out an email that told everybody they really needed to listen in tonight. But, wow, you guys just keep like I said, I don't know if there's ever going to be a climax of Benghazi, but, boy, you're getting pretty close to this.
Yeah, it is. Really to the point where it's so explosive and so unbelievable that it is unbelievable. People refuse to believe it. And one of the things that happened after the Benghazi attacks and after the filmmaker for Innocence of Muslims was jailed, he became a sympathetic figure, even in conservative media. And we, at the time, we kept raising red flags about that. He should not be a sympathetic figure. And we had a lot of suspicions, but they've all but been confirmed at this point. Nakula Baseli Nakula, the guy known as Sam Basile in the days after the Benghazi attack, was arrested by the L.A. Sheriff's Department remember, with the towel around his face,
right,
and traipsed off to jail. And then he was prosecuted and sent to prison. And even conservative media, when we raised the concerns that, hey, this guy is not who you think he is, quit defending him.
He was a real towel head. We used to call him that, 10 years or 15 years ago, before it got politically incorrect to pick on Muslims, we used to call him towel heads, you know. And so,
well, this was towel face.
Okay, towel. Yeah, okay. He's a towel face. He ain't like a Taliban.
Yeah, so anyway, we found out that people were just, they were too invested in his position of this guy being a sympathetic figure. Well, at the time, also, one of the actresses that, and this is where the break came for us recently, one of the actresses in that movie, her name is Cindy Lee Garcia, she sued Google and demanded that they take down the video because she was one of the actors in the movie that was deceived. If you remember, the movie was supposed to be called Desert Warrior, and it was billed as having nothing to do with Islam. And all these actors read the script and did everything, and then Nakula went in post-production and dubbed the inflammatory words into their lines, which is what made the film so controversial. So Cindy Lee Garcia sued Google, demanding that they take down the video. Well, again, people in the media didn't appreciate what she was doing because they were kind of lumping her into the anti-Nakula crowd and saying that she was going after the First Amendment. From everything that we can determine is that she is a very patriotic conservative American. And she contacted us a few days ago and wanted to tell us something. And she agreed that we could record the phone conversation, and you can listen to it at shoebot.com, mm-hmm, at the post that you talked about.
Right.
And in this phone conversation, she says that she read one of our articles that we had written about the filmmaker and really had her suspicions raised. I mean, this woman really engaged in critical thinking after her character was being assassinated and she was being,
right,
smeared and everything else. And she understands much of what we have uncovered, and she came to it, much of it, on her own. But she read an article that we had written about a month ago or 3 weeks ago and decided to confront Nakula, the filmmaker, and called him 3 weeks ago. And apparently he was angry about something. And she asked him point blank, are you a Muslim? And he said yes. And she asked him one more time just to confirm that she heard what she thought she heard. And he said yes again. This is all by itself extremely explosive. Because what this demonstrates is that this man who portrayed himself as a Coptic Christian, who made this video, this anti-Islamic video, from a Coptic Christian perspective, actually made it from a Muslim perspective. Why would a Muslim make a video that's anti-Islam while portraying himself as a Christian? The answer is simple, and it's one word, agitprop. It was propaganda. It was designed to gin up anti-Islamic sentiment in the Middle East, which it did a good job of that, but I believe it did the reason that it did a good job. I mean, we're out here in the heartland, Pastor Dan. I mean, we're doing stuff constantly that we think should be picked up by media. This guy does a two-bit, third-rate, pathetic video,
right?
And it gets picked up by international media. It gets picked up by President Barack Obama after it only had 300 views, and is used as an excuse for the Benghazi attack. I mean, this was part of an operation. It was part of an operation inside the Obama administration.
Okay, stop for just one second.
Yeah.
Folks, I don't know if – I don't even know – Ben, is that, that – I don't know if the video is even still around on YouTube. But it,
no, it
was
taken down.
But I saw it. It was stupid. I don't see how in any way it could have did any of the things that it said to do. Let it go and go viral. But it was just literally stupid. I couldn't even stand to watch it. It was so stupid.
Yeah, it was incredibly bad, you know, terribly done. It was two-bit third rate is what I like to call it, because that's what it was. But here's why, and you have to look at the timeline, and if you've read the article, you already know where I'm going with this.
Right.
In July of 2011, actually it started in March. In March of 2011, the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution. See, this is all about, when you trace this all back, it all goes back to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The 57 Muslim countries in the world that are, you know, have their own outfit. This goes back years, 15 years. One of their primary objectives was to create an environment to pressure non-Muslim countries and governments to enact laws and enforce laws that would prohibit and criminalize the criticism of Islam. And they weren't making headway. So in March of 2011, the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution 1618, and the purpose of this resolution was to approach it from a completely different angle, to approach it from the angle of interfaith dialogue, where you're talking about you know, let's get all of the religions together and everybody make nicey nice, and let's pass out the coexist bumper stickers, those pieces of garbage, and let's have everybody, you know, get along, and let's shame people, you know, make it a cultural thing. If we can't get governments to make this illegal, let's create cultures.
Right,
where it's taboo, it's frowned upon, it's, you know, you're not allowed to do it, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the effort. So on July 15th of 2011 was the first meeting of what became known as the Istanbul Process. The Istanbul Process was a meeting that was held in the city of its namesake, Istanbul, Turkey. It was co-chaired by three individuals. One individual, Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. The OIC executive director at the time, I can't even pronounce his name, Ingushulu or something. the Secretary General of the OIC, and he was from Turkey. So he, at the time, the Secretary General for that organization was a Turk, and also the Foreign Minister of Turkey, who's still in that position. His name is Ahmet Davutoglu. They chaired this meeting, and this was the first in a series of meetings in the Istanbul process. And one of the things that Hillary Clinton said in this meeting is she stressed what I talked about earlier. We need to get people to shame one another. She talked about peer pressure and shaming people into not doing things that, quote, we abhor, meaning don't criticize religions. We abhor that. So shame people. The government can't do it, so we are asking people, you know, citizens to do it, to shame people with peer pressure. That was the message. Now, if you look at Nakula Baseli Nakula, the filmmaker, this man was perceived as a what? Citizen, not a member of the government. He was perceived as a creature of the culture, a private citizen that did this bad and mean and awful thing of making a video, and he was then supposed to be publicly shamed for doing it. When in reality, he was an agent of the government itself. How can I say that?
No, I was just going to say, and that was the second article. Going right along.
How do we know he's an agent? It's a confirmed fact. This man was an agent of the Obama administration, and in particular, he was an agent of the Eric Holder Justice Department. Because in 2009, he was arrested in a bank fraud scheme, and it was a pretty big deal. I mean, it was felony bank fraud, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in June of 2010, he was sentenced to 21 months in prison, and he got out early. I think he got out of prison basically in June of 2011. He got out of prison 1 year later. I think he went to a halfway house or something. But what's interesting is that he was given a reduced sentence. This is very key. I would ask that everybody listen closely to this because this pieces a lot of this together. In June of 2010, he was given a lesser prison sentence, about a year taken off of his sentence, under the auspices that he would help the federal government, i.e. the Justice Department and the FBI and the Criminal Division of the Justice Department, that he would help them catch his partner in crime. His partner in crime was a guy by the name of Iyad Salome. Iyad Salome was the ringleader of this fraud operation, according to Nakula. There was a indictment for Iyad for a 2006 fraud operation. So they allegedly wanted this guy. Now, in 2011, January, very beginning of 2011, we're going to go a few months after Nakula was sentenced. In January of 2011, the Canadian Peel Police picked up Iyad. They arrested him in Canada.
Right.
And they contacted the FBI and made several attempts to get the FBI to take him. The FBI refused for several months, we believe until July or August of 2011. At which point they ultimately threw up their hands and stuck Iyad on a plane and sent him back to Palestine. Now, a couple things. That raised a flag with us because Iyad is a fundamentalist Muslim. And we learned, we started raising these questions back in October of 2012. Iyad, as a fundamentalist Muslim, what on earth is he doing partnering in crime with a Coptic Christian? Iyad is the first cousin of Waleed Shubat. Waleed Shubat knows Iyad. And this is how we know he was arrested by the Canadian Peel Police, because they contacted Waleed at the time and told him.
Really?
Waleed knows Iyad. Iyad hates Coptic Christians. So that was our question. Why would this guy partner with a Coptic Christian if he hates Coptic Christians?
Right.
The answer was given to us a few days ago by Cindy Lee Garcia. She confronted him and asked him if he is a Muslim, and he said yes. That's what we suspected, and it was confirmed to us through Garcia 2 days ago. But here's something else, is that Nakula, if Nakula was given a lesser sentence to help the feds catch Iyad, why did the feds not take Iyad when he was offered to them?
Right.
That is the question that needs to be answered. And because obviously he was given a lesser prison sentence for something other than that, because they didn't want Iyad. So what was that the feds gave him a lesser prison sentence for? We believe that the that was the production of a fake, contrived agitprop movie that was going to be used as a vehicle for pushing the agenda in the Istanbul process to cause an outrage publicly against this speech, against speech that's
right.
Critical of Islam, and to pressure countries, governments, et cetera, to enact laws to prevent, to criminalize Islam. That's what this was about all along. And one other thing, July 15th was the day that Hillary kicked off the Istanbul process. July 14th, and this is of 2011, July 14th is when Nakula began casting for his video.
Wow. Those aren't, if you want to say, oh, those are coincidences, I don't believe in coincidences, let alone in a sequential thing like that. Those things just happen in line, and, you know, they're being uncovered. The connection is just getting deeper and deeper and deeper. To put in plain terms, the guy, I even remember they were talking about the law right when Benghazi had, well, we needed to not let Muhammad be shamed. Well, anyway, mm-hmm. We'll be back, and we're going to go to break, but where should they go to find the articles?
Go to SHOEBAT.com, and for goodness sakes, call your congressman.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd suggest emailing the articles to them, I think it would be much better if you called them. But email campaign doesn't hurt either, but call them. You need to call them, call them, call them. This needs to be brought up in the Benghazi hearings to see what they have to say about this. And then we'll be back in 3 minutes because Ben's got a lot more to talk about.
Pastor Dan will be right back.
Order Doc Mike's book, How to Practice Medicine Without a License. Be Your Own Doctor for only $14.95, plus $2 postage and handling. Call Doc Mike direct at 708-488-8887. Or go to wakeupwell.org. That's wakeupwell.org to order Doc Mike's book, How to Practice Medicine Without a License. Be Your Own Doctor for only $14.95 plus $2 postage and handling. Or call 708-488-8887. That's 708-488-8887. Order now.
If you have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices going up, homes being foreclosed, unemployment insurance running out, jobs leaving the country. Many people cannot afford to eat or keep a roof over their head. Too many can do neither. Messiah's Branch has a mission church in Wichita, Kansas that helps the victims of this banker's economy, the American people, your neighbors. The mission is the last hope for so many Americans. We need your help to lift up the poorest of the poor. These are men, women, and children who once had homes, now in the street. They all need what you need: first aid, beds, food, clothing, and so on. You can send a monetary gift or a box of necessities to 230 West 4th Street, Florence, Kansas 66851, or donate online by going to WichitaHomeless.com or simply call 316-619-4886. 316-619-4886.
We are back. This is Pastor Dan Catlin, and you're listening to Messiah's Branch Prophecy Hour on the American Voice Radio Network. And I started to mention Mission Watch. That was on at 5 o'clock tonight, and we had a really good interview with the author of a book called Push Back, and that'll be in our radio archives, both at our website, prophecyhour.com, and it'll be up in a little while at ABR. Make sure you listen to that program if you haven't. It was a really good program. Anyway, but please remember to pray tonight about a donation for our work with the homeless and poor from our mission church in Wichita, Kansas. We really need your help, folks. You know, when summertime comes, people think, well, the homeless don't and the poor don't need as much because it's warm outside. Well, missions tend to kick them out in the summertime. There's more women on the street. There's more children on the street. Poor people bring their children into us to feed them lunch, and so on and so forth, looking for clothing. And then, but our donations are for the summer months when school's out, just turn to a trickle. And so we really do need your help during these summer months. Like right now, we're not completely caught up with even radio airtime for this month, and I don't think from last month. We need to get that caught up, and we need to get bills caught up. So pray about a donation. All right? Anyway, so you can donate online or by mailing a check or money order, and you can find all this information at prophecyhour.com. That's prophecyhour.com. Or call me at 620-878-4682 if you need to. Now we are back with Ben Barrick. Are you there with us, Ben?
Affirmative.
Affirmative. I have somebody that wants to know. You know who Valerie Jarrett is?
Yes.
What do you think, what is her, for the people that's never even heard the name, who is Valerie Jarrett, and wasn't she born in Iran?
Valerie Jarrett was born in Iran, and she is basically the Karl Rove of the Obama administration. She is the most relied upon advisor of Barack Obama. And in fact, I think as the Obama administration has become more and more enmeshed in scandal, the more they close ranks, and she's more of a protector, if you will, of the Obama family. The thing that's interesting about Valerie Jarrett, too, is that we talked earlier about agitprop. Agitprop is a Soviet style technique to create, to agitate and to create propaganda for the purposes, much of the same exact purpose as what we saw with this video.
And Valerie Jarrett's father-in-law, Vernon Jarrett, and Frank Marshall Davis, who was Barack Obama's childhood mentor for several years, Vernon Jarrett and Frank Marshall Davis were colleagues in Chicago. So there is a connection between the Obamas and Jarrett that goes way back to before Barack Obama was even born. And so as a Communist Party USA member, Frank Marshall Davis was wanted by the FBI for 19 years. He was being traced by the FBI. There's a file on him for 19 years from 1944 to 1963. And his connection to Vernon Jarrett is very interesting in light of Valerie Jarrett's connection to Barack Obama. Now, as a CPUSA member, Frank Marshall Davis was not only familiar with agitprop, but he was that was his area of expertise. He was a writer and poet for newspapers. He was a Soviet style propagandist whose specialty was agitprop, and he was Barack Obama's mentor from the age of about 10 to 18. So Jarrett's connection to Frank Marshall Davis through her father-in-law is indeed quite interesting.
Let me say something here. And folks, you need to look at this. You know, if you really took a chalkboard maybe and wrote all these things on a chalkboard and made all the connections, number one, none of these people with these kind of connections should have ever passed security clearances to get into the White House, period, let alone the president himself. Having said that, I mean, this is just insane. You know, the person that wanted me to ask you about that also said, so Obama has an Iranian advisor and Hillary has a Muslim sisterhood advisor. I mean, how ludicrous can you get?
Yeah, and it's your point. Yeah. To your point about security clearances and all that, the real problem stems from Obama himself not being vetted by the media, because the fact that he got to where he is allows for all of those other things to happen, because it doesn't matter if Valerie Jarrett or Huma Abedin or a slew of others doesn't pass a security clearance. If the president of the United States wants the person in the person will be in the position. So the real problem is the actual election of Barack Obama that was facilitated by, practically gift-wrapped by the mainstream media. The mainstream media is probably the most complicit entity in this entire mess that we're in. It failed to do its job, which allows corruption to flourish. And that's exactly what happened. And I'll tell you something else.
Go ahead. I'll ask afterwards.
Well, to tie it back to what we were talking about earlier, the envoy, Barack Obama's envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the same OIC that Hillary spoke at the Istanbul Process meeting on July 15th of 2011, the OIC envoy for the Obama administration is a guy named Rashad Hussein. He is a confirmed infiltrator of the U.S. government. He is a Muslim Brotherhood operative. He is a confirmed liar. And he is pushing. He has spoken at least one of the OIC Istanbul Process meetings. I believe he was just recently, and he picked up on the same sentiment. So even with the Innocence of Muslims video being exposed and that whole thing going up in smoke, this guy is still pushing the Istanbul Process agenda to criminalize speech, and at this meeting he echoed much of the sentiment that Hillary expressed back in 2011. So this guy has no business being in the administration as well. And I remember when he was selected He's also what is known as a Hafiz, by the way, which is he's memorized the Quran from front to back. He was nominated by Obama in 2010 for this position. Early on in that process, it was revealed that he spoke at a 2004 Muslim Student Association event and during his speech expressed sympathies for convicted Muslim terrorist financier Sami Al-Aryan. And it made the media. It made news reports on Fox, but they kind of dropped it. They kind of dropped it, and I never did understand why. I remember screaming, where is this story? Because what happened was this story came out. The story came out that he was at the MSA event and that he said these things. But he denied saying them. But when you go back to the news article that was written at the time, it was written, I don't remember the lady's name, but she wrote the article. It did not quote him as being the one who said it. And it didn't even, I forget, they edited it out. And they went and they talked to the writer. But if you looked at an archive version of it, it was in there. And they asked the writer, the people went to ask the writer, what's up with this? Did he say it? He says he didn't say it. And she said, if I put it in there that he said that, then he said it. And so there was some back and forth, and there was some debate about who took this out of the original article. And ultimately, it was learned that Rashad Hussein had to admit that he lied because an audio recording of the event came out, and it was released by Politico on a Friday night document dump. And Rashad Hussein was caught flat busted. The Obama administration was caught busted, obviously putting pressure on that newspaper to take out the quotes attributed to Hussein so that he could lie about ever saying them. And then he had to backtrack and admit that he did say them. So my question at the time, and it remains, is why in the world is he allowed to stay in that position? That was 4 years ago. But nobody has called him out on it, and he has been one of the most influential Muslim Brotherhood infiltrators in the Obama administration. And as a member of the as the envoy to the OIC, he is very involved in the Istanbul process that the anti-Muhammad video was supposed to be a part of.
You know what would be really interesting, and you'd be the guy to do it, if you could make some kind of a diagram with all the pictures and stuff and all the connections and put it on a page so people could just go, boom, like I was talking about the chalkboard, and go, really, you know, and see all those connections to the various people. You ought to really seriously consider that. Speaking of connections, I mean, let's go with this, and this isn't a top of the news. We're talking about your article you wrote, CIA director accused of converting to Islam, pushed for the release of the Taliban commanders. So what's your take on the Taliban commanders?
This stinks to high heaven. In fact,
like it all does, John, but...
yeah. John Brennan, the CIA director, John Guandolo, if you know who that is from the Team B2 report and Understanding the Threat, I think is what he calls his organization, he made the explosive charge last February of 2013 when John Brennan was being considered as the nominee for the position of CIA director after David Petraeus had left. And John Guandolo made the explosive charge that he knows two people in the government personally that came to him. They would not give their names, they would not come forward, but they came to him and told them that he was that they were present and witnessed John Brennan convert to Islam when in Saudi Arabia as the CIA station chief in the 1990s, I believe 96 to 98 under the Clinton administration, and that Brennan was the victim, shall we say, of a counterintelligence operation to turn him. And all these years later, here we are, John Brennan is now the CIA director. Well, what we learned with the release of these Taliban commanders It's been yet another scandal for the Obama administration because they miscalculated at best. I think that the effort was an attempt to distract people from things like Benghazi and like the VA scandal to something that they thought they could turn in their favor. I mean, Alinsky said, use all of the events of the period for your purpose. That's what Obama does. That's all he knows. And lately, and I'll get back to Brennan in a second, but lately, Obama's brilliance, shall we say, and I use the term sarcastically and loosely, has been that he has been able to, whenever the heat gets too close on one particular issue, directing and redirecting and distracting people to another issue so that they take their mind off the original one that would burn him and they focus on another one that wouldn't do as much damage. And then eventually both crises would neutralize each other and everything would go away. But what he's learning, I think, and what we should take hope in is the fact that every time he diverts to a new scandal now, it only compounds his problems.
Right.
So I think that the effort to release Bo Bergdahl was an attempt to divert from the
VA scandal,
and also to help Hillary and the administration rehabilitate their image on Benghazi. I mean, what happened? Here, look, follow this. And I promise I won't forget about Brennan, but follow this. Friday, the Friday that George Shinseki, well, I don't remember his first name, the Eric Shinseki, the Friday that Eric Shinseki resigns, he no longer is the face of the VA scandal. Who's going to fill the vacuum? Well, Obama's going to fill the vacuum. But wait, the next day, Bo Bergdahl is released. Rose Garden ceremony, everything else, blah, blah, blah. VA scandal is now gone, off the radar. And the other thing is that what happened on the Sunday? Susan Rice came out and said, we don't leave any man behind, reference to Benghazi. And Bo Bergdahl served with honor and distinction so the administration could rehabilitate on Benghazi, not leaving men behind, and also it could portray itself as giving a darn about veterans. That was the administration's attempt to use all the events of the period for its purpose and to distract away from Benghazi and the VA scandal by also showing that it can fix both. And that was what that was all about, and it didn't work. It backfired,
It blew up.
It blew up. And what we learn is that John Brennan is pushed hard for the release of these five Taliban commanders. So from the stand, and it was John Brennan was pushing hard for it. James Clapper and Clap Off and James Clapper and who was the other guy? Dennis McDonough, I think. No. Clapper and Leon Panetta.
Leon Panetta
objected to releasing these five, and Brennan has been pushing for them. Now, if Brennan did convert to Islam, that might explain why he would want these five Taliban commanders released. And why somebody, Leon Panetta and Jim Clapper, as left leaning or seemingly out of touch as they are, Brennan was even worse than them, obviously, because he wanted these Taliban commanders released. So
let me say something. Giving these commanders back clearly was aiding and abetting the enemy. And then you had Hillary glued up, and she—I don't think it was on Sawyer's interview, which I liked. She ripped her. Said that she stood up and said that they were no threat to the United States, but they were definitely a threat to Afghanistan and some other place, I don't remember where. But they were no threat to the American people because they'd never get back over here. Really?
Yeah. Well, these are commanders. And the 19 hijackers that hit us in 9/11 were not commanders. They followed the lead of commanders. I mean, these guys that were released are kind of like Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds. These are the guys that are able to strategize and move the, you know, and get the 19 hijackers to carry out their plot. They're able to almost like terrorist visionaries. You know, this is how we're going to do it. Here's the operation. Get your guys you need. And they marshal their terrorist forces, and they get them to do what they want them to do. So these guys absolutely are a threat to the homeland. I mean, they may not ever set foot on American soil again, but that doesn't mean that they don't have operatives here that will do their bidding. I mean, that's what they do. That's how they – and, in fact, they're in Qatar right now. And they're roaming free. They got their own villas. They're seeing their families. I mean, they were sent over there and just let loose. And I believe, I don't have any evidence of this, but it wouldn't surprise me if they are going to be utilized, to help the Syrian rebels. Qatar,
right.
Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, and the U.S. has been very invested in the Syrian rebels against Bashar al-Assad.
Right.
And, you know, these five Taliban commanders, as agents of that wing, that al-Qaeda, you know, fundamentalist Muslim wing, Sunnis, these people would necessarily almost support the Syrian rebels, and they're in a country that supports the Syrian rebels. So it wouldn't surprise me if they play a role in that somehow.
Well, let me throw a couple things out here and see if it sticks to anything. You know, we're hearing about Iraq being invaded, and you know, these people that are not Iraq, and they hit the bank in Mosul, and they got something like, I don't know, $400 and some odd million. From there, and these guys that did that are part of the same rebels that are fighting in Syria. So it looks like that Syrian war just got financed. But come to find out, Iraq has been trying to get help to fend these guys off for weeks, not just today or yesterday when it happened, but they've been trying to stop them for weeks and has asked for Americans to do it. Throw another thing in there. I know it's going to have some kind of orchestrated command, but I don't know how it's going to tie in. All these children coming, do they want us to believe that all these children walked up from South America by themselves and that wasn't orchestrated, and we're finding out too that anybody can come across the border, meaning terrorists? I wonder how those are going to end up tying in, because you know they got to. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know where the news about Iraq broke. I don't know who broke it first. But again, I think that we're watching Obama in desperation. I think we're watching this influx of illegal aliens. This is obviously an attempt. It's another desperate attempt. And I'm saying that this kind of in a bizarre way gives us a sense of hope. The administration is flailing right now. And they are attempting to, again, redirect focus towards these illegals coming over and also believing that it's going to help their agenda. This is backfiring. Everything he's doing now is backfiring. That should give us hope. It's backfiring because these illegals are ending up in military camps, which is absurd, by the way. They're ending up in these places, and they're not able to – they're not able to be cared for.
It's insane.
It's not doing what Obama wants it to do. He's exploiting people, innocent people, for his own advantage. And we're hearing in the news reports that these kids are, and this is the bad part of this, these illegal alien kids are not able to be cared for and may die because we don't have the capacity to deal with this. That's
right,
why we need
right.
border enforcement. They never should be in here in the first place. We need order. And you know, that's the problem
here.
And
okay, well, let me throw this out here. And you hit the nail on the head. They're failing. Well, you know, there's been a couple of professors that have come forward, and one recent, I don't remember his name, that just got through saying that, saying he believes that Obama is mentally ill and he's not living in the real world because these things that he's doing doesn't make sense and there's no way they can work. And, you know, so, and he was a leftist. You understand what I'm saying? A leftist psychiatrist came forward and he's worried about Obama. But my problem is this guy doing all this, and he still has his hand on on a nuclear button. What is this guy capable of in the next, what, we got 3 years, something like that, 2 years or whatever? What is he capable of?
Well, you know, those are definitely concerns. And I had those concerns. I don't know how many people I don't know if I ever talked to you about this on the air, but I had. Let's see, November 4th, he was elected on November 4th of 2008. On November 2nd of 2008, I had this overwhelming, I don't know what you, it wasn't so much a vision as an overwhelming awareness, a flood of emotion that hit me about the very thing you just mentioned. That it, I had studied Obama so much. I'll never forget it. I remember the date. I remember where I was. I remember what was going through my mind. I mean, it lasted for about 5 minutes, and it was incredibly intense. And it was because that I had so studied and understood that every relationship that this man has had has been with evil. Every relationship
right.
this man has been with the wrong people. And here he was, about to become the president of the United States, and I knew that that portended bad things, and it was like it hit me all at once. And I got to be honest, I had the thought that you just mentioned. I mean, we're talking
right.
about the commander-in-chief of the United States who has access to nuclear weapons.
Yeah, absolutely.
This guy distracts from problem to problem, keep escalating to a bigger problem, hoping that it will take attention away from the other one. You follow that to its logical conclusion. At what point does he become that desperate? And it sounds crazy, and I pray to God that that's not, you know, something that we should fear or worry about. But I agree with the professor to some extent. This guy is not stable. He's not stable. And frankly, a lot of us knew this before 2008.
Right,
and,
absolutely.
And that's what's so maddening.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, Ben. I really, when he first was elected, I literally was ill for a couple of months over the whole reality of it. But real quick, give a website, and I got to say goodbye. We got to get out of here.
Shoebat.com, Shoebat.com, and WBDaily.com.
WBDaily.com. All right. Be blessed. We'll talk again, I'm sure.
All right, take care.
All right, bye-bye. Folks, really powerful program. You need to share it with others and take heed of what we're saying. This is a real problem. But pray about supporting the Mission Church. Remember, there's only one God. He's your father. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. His son is Yeshua HaMashiach. He gave his life for our repented sins. He rose after 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. And through him, and only through him, is the way to the Father. Remember, please, always be a blessing to others. Always, always, always. Pray about the Mission Church, Lord our God, Father, King of the universe, asking Yeshua HaMashiach's name that the Father blesses and keeps you, his face shines upon you and is gracious to you and gives you peace like no one or nothing else can. Until next Thursday, this is Pastor Dan saying goodbye and shalom.
You've just heard the Messiah's Branch broadcast featuring Pastor Dan. To contact Dan on the internet, go to messiahsbranch.org. To write to Dan, send a note to Messiah's Branch, 230 West 4th Street, Florence, Kansas, 66851. Tune in next time for Messiah's Branch.